York City Green Building Law.
Okay.
Local Law 86.
Great. Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the breakout panel on energy efficiency, city programs, and job creation. My name is Don Gilligan. I'm the president of the National Association of Energy Service Companies. I'm going to moderate the panel and give a brief introductory presentation. So without further ado, I think I have to move over here because we don't have the right hardware.
We have some technical difficulties.
Yeah. See if I can get a microphone close enough to switch the slides. Here we go. Okay. My presentation is going to have three brief elements. One is a potential scale of the energy efficiency marketplace in the country, the employment potential from energy efficiency, and then the availability of program and project financing to actually realize this scale. To put the energy efficiency market into some perspective, estimates are that energy efficiency has provided about 75% of our new energy needs since 1970. That means increased efficiency in cars, increased efficiency in industrial processes, homes, buildings, appliances. It's a tremendous amount of stuff that's been going on, much of it below the radar screen. California is perhaps the best example of this, where energy use in California has not grown on a per capita basis in 30 years. In the rest of the country, it's grown about 50% per capita. I don't think that too many of us would think that Californians live a deprived life, even though their energy use hasn't grown, because they've enjoyed the fruits of some very aggressive energy efficiency and renewables program. The good news is that there's plenty more available. Last year, there was a group put together by the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. EPA called the National Action Plan for Energy Efficiency. Consisted of about 50 members plus about 20 observers, utilities, end users, industry regulators. They looked at the potential for energy savings that was available. You have to understand a couple of caveats. With commercially available technology today, now bear in mind that in the energy efficiency business, the lighting technology that we're installing today didn't exist 10 years ago. So if we're looking ahead 10 years and saying we're limiting ourselves to what's commercially available today, it's a tremendously conservative estimate. They looked at 9 studies from across the country, anywhere from 10 to more than 40% potential savings in electricity, 10 to 20% in natural gas. Lots of savings. What would you need to achieve those savings? Well, they said you'd need a $7 billion program annually, which is something like 3.5 times the current utility spending. A tiny fraction, of course, of the Apollo goal, which is a $300 million program. So we're looking at a little bitty piece here. This kind of an investment would produce savings that would cost, on average, about 4 cents a kilowatt hour, or $3 a therm for gas. Now, I don't know how many of you are in a position where you could buy supply for that. I would think if you were, you wouldn't be sitting in this room. You'd be arbitraging that ability to purchase. But those are tremendously attractive prices. My current electricity bill is about 20 cents a kilowatt hour outside of Austin. This program, the $7 billion investment program, would have a net present value of about $340 billion over a 15-year period, and it would achieve annual savings to consumers of about $22 billion a year by 2017. What's the employment potential of that? Well, we've got a couple of studies. I'll talk to you. One is a sort of micro study of a single state. One is a larger study of a region. Micro study of New York State, which runs a $150 million a year program, They produce 4,200 jobs a year and about almost $250 million in economic growth. And I'll give you some sources for this data at the end. The Midwest, the American Council for an Energy Efficiency Economy did a study a couple of years ago and looked at the potential for energy savings in the Midwestern states. You may know that there are eight or nine Midwestern states who in total ship $40 billion a year out of their state, out of that economy, to buy natural gas. So ACEEE said, what could we do to save some of those jobs, some of that money? They put together an $800 million a year program by the year 2010. You have to push that back now because the study's a couple of years old. But after about 5 years, you'd have 30,000 jobs and $750 million a year in additional labor income. In 15 years, you'd have 66,000 jobs and almost $2 billion a year in additional income. What are we talking about? All we're talking about here is substituting skilled local labor for energy resources that are imported in either into the region or into the country. This isn't rocket science. This is a graphic pulled out of the New York study, and again, the citation is at the end of the slides, which shows where in New York they believe that the jobs are being created in what industries. The next slide is what states in the Midwest would benefit most from the big natural gas program in the Midwest. And you see that many of the states are the states which have suffered the biggest job losses in industrial production over the last decade. Again, going back to the NAPI program, if we projected out some of those, the New York study or the ACEEE study across the country, using as a benchmark a $7 billion a year program, if you use the New York figures, it's 200,000 jobs a year. If you use the ACEEE, it's 575,000 jobs. So pick a mid-range, you're close to 400,000 jobs. One of the differences between the two, wonder why there's such a big difference, is that the NYSERDA study really doesn't look so much at the total potential. They're looking at the potential or the jobs that have been generated by their programs only. And one of the big differences in these studies is that the NYSERDA study really doesn't include a lot of the long-term operating jobs that are going to be required in buildings. I mean, one of the things that people who have been in the industry for a long time know is that there are almost no buildings that are operated optimally. Building operation is not a one-shot routine. I can come into this room, change the lights, and leave, and that'll make a significant difference in terms of the energy consumption for lighting. But after I've gone, somebody has to operate this building, which is a complex building with complex systems, complex computerized controls. That's not being done. There are very good jobs that are permanent jobs. These are not one-hit jobs. These are jobs which stay forever in operating all of our buildings. We're simply not doing it very well. The way that we operate buildings is mostly by, you know, it's like setting up a production line. You come in, you tune it up the first time, the guy who sets it up leaves, and then nobody ever looks at it again. And you wonder why 5 years down the road it's not running quite right. Yeah, these are annual jobs. That's not cumulative. How do you finance this? Well, again, going back to the $7 billion a year program, you would finance it through utility bills, about 2% of electric utility revenues, or 0.5% of gas utility revenues. It's equivalent to 20,000 megawatts of electricity supply. It's part of a future portfolio. It's not the entire solution in the future, but it's part of a portfolio of things that the utility should be doing. We think it's much more reliable and much much steadier work. If you want an example of that, you may have read over the weekend a big buyout firm announced that it was going to buy a major Texas utility. One of the things that it was going to do is not build 8 planned coal plants. Well, in one stroke by a couple of guys in New York, you wiped out thousands of man-years of work. If that same money, instead of being plowed into the coal plants, was plowed into energy efficiency, you couldn't wipe it out like that. It's much more grasp. Yes, one project may die or a couple projects over here may die, but 98% of the program keeps going. And again, you're looking at a huge net present value gain for the country. In terms of project finance, bigger projects and bigger buildings, public facilities are very well served. There's more than $20 billion worth of projects have been completed at the federal, state, and local government level. There's a very robust private competitive market. States operate all kinds of, there's plenty of money in this environment floating around, plenty of money. So that's really not the issue. The issue is the motivation to get the work done, to get into the buildings. Here are some citations. And I'll give whoever, Dan or Rich, the electronic copy of this, and hopefully it can distribute it to everybody. Thank you. Steve, you want to go next? Next up is Steve Cowell, who's the president of Conservation Services Group. Conservation Services Group operates a number of... a number of energy efficiency programs across the country, in what states? Massachusetts.
I can introduce myself while Don's figuring this out. Don and I go back many, many years. Our kids were best friends, very close friends. Don is one of the few people I know whose both father and sister are past or current governors in the United States. And he's, for that family background, he's particularly non-political. CSG is a nonprofit 501c3. We run energy efficiency programs and renewable energy programs. If you live in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Oregon, California, most likely anything you see from the utility companies out there is run by CSG. We are sort of the guts of the delivery, whether it's marketing, quality assurance, training, technical support, implementation services for those programs. We have about 300 staff people, and we manage about $250 million. This year, we're looking to do $250 million worth of energy efficiency investments in the country will be managed by CSG. And it's a challenge to do that. We worry every house. We're responsible for about 100,000 facilities getting upgraded every year. And the standards that is done, how well it's done, how effectively it's done, are something that we're responsible for. And when we make a mistake, or someone, anyone associated with us, in any way, shape, or form makes a mistake, we have to fix it really quick. So we have to be fast on our feet. What I'm going to try to do is, picking up where Don left off, is do two things. One is do sort of a sort of review of what kind of jobs we're talking about with efficiency and renewables and how they come together in high-performance buildings. The concept of a high-performance building is one that both is efficient to operate and uses as much as possible non-fossil fuel-based PV, biodiesel cogeneration, microturbines, things like that, new modes of heating, cooling, and electricity in buildings, and they're green and sustainable. So there's a whole broad range of that. So let's talk. What I want to do is just quickly do a sort of a punch list let's see if this works. What do these jobs look like, and what's the rationale? Don talked a little bit about energy efficiency and its impact on jobs, efficiency by lowering the use of energy through substituting capital and labor for energy. It's really what you're doing. creates more jobs than trying to produce it. High-performance buildings meaning being economic and environmental performance. So they really are just not performing from the point of view of economics and energy use. They're also performing from the point of view of the built environment, the human environment, in terms of their safety, their durability, the ability of human beings to live in those buildings is part of it. These jobs are higher skilled and higher paid in many ways than a lot of our existing energy infrastructure jobs. And when you're talking of these are inherently end-use solutions, meaning solutions in our buildings mean local jobs. We're not exporting jobs someplace else. So those are some of the sort of features. So what I'm going to try to do is talk about what's the punch list of jobs, types of jobs. Then I'm going to go over a couple of examples of unions, of organized labor, really looking at this as a growth opportunity to expand. So number one, home construction and renovation. The traditional home construction and renovation has people who drive nails and put on roofs and things like this. With a high-performance building environment, you have a whole set of jobs around performance testing, whereby you have equipment and diagnostic equipment from infrared cameras, things called blower doors, duct blasters, manometers, computer simulation tools. All of these, it's sort of like the transformation in the auto industry when they introduced computer diagnostics. It meant that the people fixing the cars had to have higher skills. People who were building houses and building buildings, both building them and fixing them up in a high-performance building environment, have to have higher skills, have to know how to use the diagnostic equipment to know that the house or the building is going to perform as projected. Secondly, Don alluded to the importance of building controls and automation. Our buildings are really dumb. Right now, buildings are really dumb because they don't know what to do. You have to go around and turn on switches. You have to decide what temperature you want, and invariably everyone in the family or everyone in the building fights over this issue. It's a phenomenon called dueling thermostats, and they've had pictures of families where over a course of several days, different members of the family have visited the thermostat, turned it up, turned it down, turned it up. They've had fights over it. Buildings are very stupid in that sense. They can be made smart. They can be made reactive to the needs of the power grid and much more responsive to the needs of the occupant. But it needs better controls. In this world of microchips and electronic world, we have many more opportunities for technology that's responsive, proactive, both to the needs of the building and reactive to the needs of the electric grid, both environmentally and economic. Those take technologies that will mean better jobs, smarter jobs, and more jobs managing the performance of the operation of those buildings. HVAC systems, heating and cooling equipment, both installation and maintenance, those jobs can reduce the consumption of HVAC equipment by anywhere from 20 to 40% as a result of putting them in better, maintaining them better, and using the right diagnostic tools to make them operate better. Again, jobs that require better skills and higher pay. Replacing lighting. There's some pretty dumb lighting in here. And someone should know how to replace it and maintain it. Don was talking about that. Again, their maintenance systems, they're knowing how to specify the new lighting equipment better. Then operation maintenance of buildings. The whole operation maintenance, and I'll talk about that, and I have sort of a family connection with that one as well. Renewable energy systems and distributed generation. Our buildings can be the new power plants. A large percentage, so right now it's about, we estimated recently, we just did a settlement in New England, converting the entire electric grid to accepting behind-the-meter solutions equal to central generation solutions, which means things like microturbines located in buildings can generate all or a large portion of the electricity needed for those while they're doing the heating and hot water. So combined heat and power, photovoltaics. There is one housing development in Massachusetts that's using biodiesel cogeneration system. So there are a lot of opportunities for installing the electric generation at the point of use and consumption. That's much more efficient because it eliminates transmission and distribution costs, losses, and it eliminates reserve requirements in the electric power grid. So just off the top of it, it's 25%. Again, those jobs, installing that equipment and maintaining that equipment is local, it's higher skill, it's higher pay. Environmental products. We're talking more and more across the spectrum of environmental products, everything from bamboo floors to cork to non-VOC carpet. There's a whole range of building products that are environmentally safe that are part of green buildings. You have to know about them. You have to know how to install them. You have to know what they are. Again, in the buildings products industry and in the building construction and maintenance industry, everything from non-biodegradable cleaners to non-VOC producing solvents and things like that all are changing the nature of how we maintain our buildings and doing it sustainably and doing it with a long-term view of the Earth's planet. Again, needing more skills and resulting in higher wages. There's a whole evaluation industry. There's a group called the Home Energy ResNet, which is a series of people around the country who are trained in building diagnostics to know what's wrong with buildings and know how to fix them. And these jobs, the question of where organized labor fits into this, I think there's two or three ways to grow and to build the alliance. It's interesting, one of my senior VP here, Mark Dine, and I met each other 32 years ago. He was heading up Citizen Labor Energy Coalition, CLEC, right? And the goal was to get citizen activists and labor to work together on where have we been? We're like starting over again. But better to start over again than never to have started over again. I'm going to do two quick examples of union efforts that I think are exemplary. That one is IBW 103, and Marty Akins is actually in the person who created it is in the other breakout session. He's talking about Cape Wind. I'll talk a little bit about his program. And SEIU, the Thomas Shortman training program in New York City, which trains building superintendents in New York City, are heavily unionized in BJ 32. IBEW's program, IBEW, which is the local 103 electricians union in Boston, have taken on the concept of they're going to get into and push for the introduction of skills into the electricians union around photovoltaics, wind, and distributed generation. They've got a training program. They have installation programs, and we've worked with them. And they have helped. I'm trying to look. I think that's one of my guys doing that. but we've installed a lot of photovoltaics ourselves. We try to work with them as much as possible where there is a unionized, skilled trades subsector of the electricians union knows how to deal with these technologies. So getting the unions to realize that these new technologies are in the forefront and they can build that. I think they got some training dollars internally. They got some training dollars from the state to do that, to train their electricians. They really have done a leadership role in that sort of concept of evolving the traditional trade unions into the new SEI. I'll jump to SEIU. SEIU is, of course, big union, the disclosure. Which is my sister spent 20 years as the international VP of International Ladies Garment Workers Union and then Unite. Now she's at 32BJ, and so this is a project that her union's been doing, and I've been working with her on helping do this, which is they represent building superintendents, and building superintendents can be seen as a very low-skilled job. They've got a whole training center that they've negotiated on doing skill building, and one of the things that they've done is introduce heating and cooling controls, a green building technology, energy maintenance, and energy management so that the superintendents are not a cost anymore. They're seen as a profit center for that building. because to the extent that they can reduce the operating costs of that building through better knowledge and better operation of the energy systems, they actually produce their own salary in energy savings. So it's a whole different view of labor management when labor can be seen as a profit center and not a cost center. And so the Shortman Center, which has been in existence for a long time, is moving into this whole green building and energy management, getting its employees and jointly with management companies and owners to expand that concept of a new building technology for jobs and better wages. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Elsa Barbosa, and I come from Los Angeles, and we convene. I also work for a 501c3 called SCOPE, Strategic Concepts in Organizing and Policy Education. So I'm going to stand before you coming from a different, it's funny because our slides are actually kind of the same, but we're a lot different organization. We're a social justice organization, and have spent the last 13 to 14 years doing grassroots organizing and policy in Los Angeles. And so we convened the Los Angeles Apollo Alliance exactly a year ago with the long-term vision, really, of helping to shape the regional economy in Los Angeles to be green, clean, sustainable, specifically to address poverty. So recognizing that we need a regional economic strategy to be able to address poverty at scope and scale. So meaning that with this green energy economy, that we can do mass scale job creation. So in the 60s and the 70s, a lot of people of color in low income communities got good unionized jobs in Los Angeles through aerospace, through steel companies, auto plants, public sector. And that's how we're looking at the green economy in Los Angeles, is to help to shape it to do that kind of systemic change. So we come together really to build a broad-based constituency to help to make that happen. And we see unionization as key to addressing poverty. So that this economy must include unionization of jobs with good benefits, good pay, et cetera. So we brought together three different sectors, and that is community and labor and environment. And so I'm from a community institution, and the reason why we would convene the Los Angeles Apollo Alliance is because we know best the conditions and the problems of our communities and who our constituencies are and what are the real barriers to get them to work. So we have organized a strong sector of community organizations in the LA Apollo Alliance. With labor, we also have a strong labor sector as well. And again, so labor also has a problem with their backfill of jobs of a trained workforce. So they're very interested in helping to make this happen, as well as the progressive environmental groups as well. We also developed an advisory panel of different experts in labor, academics, research, et cetera. So in Los Angeles, just again as a backdrop and just a different picture of saying that there are billions of dollars of investment that are beginning to happen and that will happen in the next five years really in Los Angeles. So these are examples of different public works projects that are happening. We have a new mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, and he's taken on this million trees. So in the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to plant a million trees. Renew LA is one program where it would be trash to energy. There is actually a river in Los Angeles that they put concrete over many years ago, and now they want to revitalize it, and that's a billions of dollar project happening in Los Angeles. There's the expansion of LAX. There's LEED standards now for the city and new developments, et cetera. So with all of these different projects, there's the expansion of the 710 freeway, which is basically about goods movement from the port to land and across the country. So there's lots of different public works projects in Los Angeles that have the potential to be green or really have the potential to do large-scale job creation. So this is, again, our kind of larger strategic goals then for the Los Angeles Apollo Alliance and for a community institution is really to establish an effective model that can position our communities to have access to those thousands of jobs. So we want to really set a precedence for how the green economy is shaped in Los Angeles. And what we really want to be spending our time on is helping to develop a model green ladder training program. So ones that Mr. Cowell described, but that are at even a larger scale. So not just on one skill, but on many skills. So we want to do, we're starting with green building. We want to set a precedence for how that is shaped. We want to also begin now to revitalize start to look at what our policies and work that needs to happen to revitalize the manufacturing base in Los Angeles. And then really just create a progressive pole around this green economy. Our first proposal is a green building proposal, and this is the way that it is going to work. One, we just passed a motion to and got the city of Los Angeles to conduct an energy audit of all of the city buildings to identify the sites and then what would be the job potential for those, what would be the job potential to do the retrofits of buildings. We want to secure, and so that audit is basically everything that Mr. Cowell went over around, what's the lighting, what are the heating systems, the air conditioning systems, the motor systems, looking at all the different, assessing all the different ways that the city buildings can be retrofitted. So there are they're looking at about 1,100 city buildings, because Los Angeles is very large, obviously. Looking at about 1,150 city buildings, looking at the oldest and the biggest first. And then, again, as an alliance would want to target city buildings that are located in inner city communities. So that can help with the environmental issues in our own communities as well as be jobs that are close to home. So secondly, we want to secure at least $100 million to retrofit a beginning list of 100 existing city buildings with energy and water efficient technologies. We want to create 2,000, through this green building proposal, doing these specific retrofits, we want to be able to create 2,000 union jobs for new and incumbent workers. We want to establish a career ladder training program to connect inner city communities to green jobs, and then again establish purchasing and other policies to see the development. So as Mr. Gilliam said, there are millions of dollars that are out there. There's lots of different financing options that we're looking at, and some that we're looking at on a very short term, and others that that will be on a more longer term basis. So there's the use of pension funds. There's also bond, lots of bonds, state bond money in California that can be used for more kind of medium-term job creation, et cetera. And then there's energy efficiency line items the Department of Water and Power just budget, as well as the City of Los Angeles budget. So again, why green building? why would we choose green building first? I mean, I think we covered most of it, but really because the reason why we picked it is because it creates a career job and it creates a career ladder, and our communities have the most potential to have access to those entry-level union jobs. I think they went over those others. So again, just to talk about scale, so just in one community, which is South Los Angeles, there's at least 200 city-owned buildings that are just in that community. So, and that doesn't include other buildings that belong to other proprietary departments or state buildings or federal buildings, but that just shows in Los Angeles that the scope and scale is possible. So this is just a picture of the words that Mr. Cowell showed. These are some of the occupations necessary to green a building. And these are all the building trades type jobs. So there's energy auditor, there's landscaper, there's the outside and the inside of the building. This is just a small example of a career ladder, and I can answer questions about that later. But again, there's with green building, there's at least three career ladders that we could start to think about now. And one is about construction. And so what needs to happen to get our communities to be at apprenticeship level? There's also the what Mr. Cowell talked about, which is the maintenance and the ongoing operations of buildings. And then there's also, again, about revitalizing the manufacturing base. So there's the career ladder in that tier as well. So lots of our union partners tell us about how they had, 50 apprenticeship slots or this many apprenticeship slots, and how, I'm not exaggerating, 3,000 people would sign up for those slots, and a very small amount of people were actually able to get into those apprenticeship programs. And so what that means for us as a community organization is that we need to be thinking about those 3,000, those 2,850 people. And that it's not just about creaming from our communities, but it really is about addressing poverty and what are the issues about that. So we are working with a program in the community college district to help to establish a public infrastructure that will work on the basic skills and pre-apprenticeship training for our communities, and then to get folks up the pipeline. Let's see what else is on here. I think that's basically it. Again, so we're just starting with green building as well as trying to make LA City a solar power capital. And it really is about, this is our year plan. All right, it was done. But it really is about getting the financing. It really is about establishing the green career ladder for our communities. There's billions of dollars of investment. Is it going to be union jobs? Is it going to help with poverty? Or is it going to add to the problem? And that's what we're trying to work on in Los Angeles. Thank you.
I think we'll stay on a theme of local programs for our next speaker. And then for our final speaker, we'll pull back up to the to a national perspective. But our next speaker is Nancy Anderson, who is the executive director of the Salon Foundation in New York, who is going to talk about a Green New York program.
Good morning, everybody. I'm here this morning on behalf of EDOT and the Central Labor Council. I don't have a slide program. I don't have PowerPoint. I'm ad-libbing it, so here goes. Everybody likes stories that have happy endings, right? Everybody loves stories that have happy endings after overcoming fearful odds. Today I'm here to talk to you about the New York City Green Building Law, known as Local Law 86. And while I'd like to say that I'm here as Little Miss Sunshine, the story is just a bit more complicated. New York City's Green Building Law was signed by Mayor Bloomberg in October of 2005. The law packs a real punch. It requires New York City government buildings, including schools, with a five-year capital construction budget of $13 billion, that's billion with a B, a lot of money, requires public buildings and a number of buildings that get city dollars to put up new structures, such as museums and other cultural centers in New York. It requires all of these buildings to be built or renovated to LEED silver standards. Oh, except for schools, which only have to be built to LEED certification standards. But that's still a lot of innovation with billions and billions of dollars behind it, and the transforming potential of those billions of dollars. And when the city builds, labor wins, because when the city builds, workers all have to receive prevailing wages. So we're talking about good jobs, skilled jobs, from the design through the construction, through the installation, through the building operation and maintenance. The transforming potentials here are enormous. And that's very good news indeed. And it's good news not just for New York, but it's good news as we see cities around the country, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, coming soon to San Francisco, green building laws. Each one has its own features, each one has its own characteristics, but they're all city after city around the country with budgets in the billions, with populations in the many, many millions. We're seeing transformations starting to take place before our eyes. And in talking about buildings and in talking about, because I come from the environmental advocacy world, we were at a session this morning talking about the challenges of greening and transforming America's transportation sector. Transportation around the United States consumes 27% of the energy produced each year in this country. Buildings consume 40%. 40% to heat, to cool, to light, to turn the computers on in the morning, 40%. In any city you're in, you look at a window and what do you see? A building. So if we can, and we are beginning to transform our building sectors to make them orders of magnitude more environmentally sustainable, more energy efficient, we will have come a long way. That's the Little Miss Sunshine part of the story, and it's real, and it's real. But as you all know, because looking out around this room today, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of years of hands-on, day-in, day-out experience with making those visions real.
I've only been at it for 5 months, but I'm just kidding.
Aggregately. We have our 21-year-olds here, and then we have the rest of us around the room. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, New York City has this wonderful, new, very ambitious green building law signed in October of 2005. It is now almost March of 2007, and that our law has not yet been implemented. It is not yet up and running. As in many places, laws are passed, and it's like getting married. Getting married is wonderful. It's the end of a happy story, right? It's also the beginning of many, many years of making it work, and maybe it will, and maybe it won't. All of us know that passing a law is like cutting the ribbon. It's just the beginning. And in New York City, We do not, we've cut the ribbon, but we don't have the law in effect yet because the rules and regulations that dot the I's and cross the T's to make it happen, to implement the program, to hire the people, to spend the money, to do the oversight, all of those important things, we have not begun to roll it out yet. New York City does have a number of wonderful, truly wonderful and innovative high-performance buildings. Just last month, a high-performance library was opened in the Bronx. The Queens Botanic Gardens has a wonderful high-performance green building. We know that the schools are, the School Construction Authority has its own bonding authority and its own money in New York. They are working on their own green building rules. It's not a public process. The New York City Steering Committee, on Steve Bowes here. Steve, raise your hand. Steve has met on a number of occasions with the School Construction Authority to help guide them and urge them to promulgate the best and the cleanest high-performance school standards for healthy schools, for healthy students, for healthy teachers. It's not a public process. Steve has a piece of what's going on, but we do not know, as a matter of public knowledge, how that $13 billion is going to be spent in New York to green our schools and to make our communities healthier. We probably in New York City, although the numbers are larger because the city is so big, but everyone in this room is a partner in making sure that the promises that we see in green building laws, high performance laws, whether they're at a city level, a county level, a state level, and who knows, someday perhaps even at a federal level. We are all partners, and we all will be partners in making sure that those promises, those wedding vows, are promises that will be delivered on, to have healthy, high-performance, green cities, to have the kinds of jobs and careers, job ladders that our sister from LA was talking about, means we need to be vigilant every day, every step of the way, to make sure that the promises are delivered on, the money is available, and that the promises are delivered on well. I want to leave you just with this thought, because one of the themes of my foundation, one of our campaigns, is a public education, a public outreach for the importance of evidence-based social policy. We need the data. We need the evidence. We need to close the feedback loop as we move forward to see if we are doing it right, to see if we are doing it well, to see if we could be doing it better. And you're all part of that campaign, and let's work together.
Our final panelist is Dave Hamilton, who leads the Sierra Club's global warming initiative here in Washington. Dave has been in Washington working on national energy policy for about 20 years, first at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, and then for a number of years at the Alliance to Save Energy. Dave?
My name is Dave Hamilton, and I was added to the agenda a little late, and I think it's because Dan saw the weather report, and he wanted somebody local. So, but here I am, and I just want to talk about the moment that we're at here in both state policy and national policy, that certainly in Washington, the last 60 days have been a different world for looking at energy efficiency, looking at buildings, looking at the possibilities that are out there. You know, as as Don said, I have been, you know, I was the policy director of the Alliance to Save Energy during the 90s when energy prices were as low as they have ever been. And so it really was like selling ice to the Eskimos. And, you know, now that we have, you know, a sense of urgency, a sense that efficiency is, in fact, the solution, that you know, we have the answers. We have the solutions. We have ways to green buildings. We have ways to build buildings. We have ways to retrofit buildings that will, you know, make it happen. I think, you know, if people were watching the Oscars last night, I hope you weren't stuck in an airport. You know, global warming is on television. I was debating with someone over whether, you know, getting the Oscar or getting the Nobel Prize was a better press hit for, you know, for the vice for Gore, but I didn't figure it out. But you know, the attention on buildings and what we do and how we do it has never been anything like this, and it's an opportunity moment that we have to capitalize on. You know, had the opportunity to spend some time with James Hansen of NASA a couple weeks ago and reiterated, boy, you know, not only do we have to move fast to stave off the worst parts of global warming, but that the first thing we have to do is to do the easiest stuff, which is energy efficiency. And of energy efficiency, if you were at the transportation panel, the easiest stuff is buildings. The problem is getting beyond some things that we've been coping with for a long time. I think that, you know, global warming is a drastic compound market failure in a way that we've never, the United States and capitalism itself has never had to deal with, we would put in danger our very well-being because we didn't make people pay for the damage they were doing. I think Vice President Cheney's remark about energy efficiency being a sign of personal virtue but not anything on which to base an energy policy was perfect. If you wanted to reinforce the stereotypes of people about energy efficiency, which is, hey, I can caulk my baseboards, I can you know, put a little rubber tubing and insulation, and I can save a nickel here and a dime there, and you know, it'll be really nice. And as opposed to the dynamic, transformative, you know, economically powerful thing that energy efficiency in buildings is. We just co-released a study with the American Solar Energy Society, which put together a bunch of the main national researchers on renewable technologies, and got Joel Swisher at the Rocky Mountain Institute, who, you know, those guys are a little more ambitious in their numbers on what is attainable, but the conclusion of the report was that of the 60 to 80% reduction that scientists say we need to make by 2050 in carbon emissions, we can get on a path by 2030 to about 72% of that with energy efficiency and renewable energy. And it's not, you know, this isn't the Sierra Club saying that. This isn't, you know, Greenpeace, although they came up with similar conclusions. These are the researchers that are most hands-on in these fields. And basically, 55% of that chunk is from energy efficiency, and 70% of that is from buildings. I was on a public television show last week with a PR guy from Texas, TXU, and I wonder if they're, I don't even know if they're going to run the show now that TXU appears to be headed for a change in direction. But you know, we argued about what was a better path. Was it building 11 coal plants, or was it, you know, doing energy efficiency and building efficiency on a very ambitious scale? And he was like, well, you know, people, they don't do it. They don't want to do it. You know, energy efficiency, it takes people. It takes, and I'm like, yeah, that's the point. It takes people. It takes jobs. It takes humans. It takes designers. It takes architects. It takes technicians. It takes manufacturers. And that, you know, if you look at the coal industry, it has been a decades-long process of cutting people out of the process. Mm-hmm. And energy efficiency is, by its very nature, is inclusive in that way. You know, working for the Alliance to Save Energy, it was the kind of the nexus of business and government and environmentalists on energy efficiency. And you'd have you know, washing machine manufacturers and insulation manufacturers and window manufacturers, and all these people comprise the energy efficiency industry, except when it came down to their interests, it was really all about selling insulation, selling washing machines, selling windows. And, you know, now we have this chance to put it together. And, you know, part of what has been the trouble with energy efficiency is that the delivery systems have taken a long time to come together. The market orientation of different efficiency approaches, you know, we've seen huge strides with Steve's group and Efficiency Vermont in California in the last 10 years about marketing products, you know, being the one-stop shop for builders, being, you know, delivering those products in a way that make it easy to overcome a lot of those market failures. You know, demand response. The California experience was a huge boon to figuring out how to deliver kilowatts, you know, in a pinch. And now in 2008, for the first time, you're going to have demand-side resources competing with supply resources on the New England ISO head-to-head. That's huge. It's a wonderful development. I would like to say that Congress was as far ahead on thinking about these problems and doing things about them as you all are, and a lot of people around the country are, but it is not happening. And yet, Congress is looking for dynamic, transformational programs that will move us forward. They want the answers, and they want, you know, they want the support to bring them. Yeah, we've got, you know, we have, you know, from an environmental standpoint, I then went back to the heart of the green world, and from the environmental standpoint with, you know, Henry Waxman chairing committee in the House and Senator Boxer in the Senate, you know, we have huge supporters and huge opportunities to do the kinds of dynamic things that we've been talking about for a long time. But we need people on the local level to be talking, to be, you know, you all need to have relationships with the legislative assistants that do these issues for your members of Congress and the Senate. And we have to be talking to them and giving them the fuel that they need to make real change. I just want to say something about cap and trade, because it looks like, you know, one of the most popular ways to deal with global warming is to set up a cap on emissions and then have a way to deal permits to bring in political constituencies and things like that. And I believe that, you know, that is useful. But the way cap and trade has been talked about up to now has been, how do we make it the least impact on the people who pollute the most now? And it's almost impossible to build an efficient system when that is your goal. What you need to do is whether it is with a set aside of allowances to, I mean, I've been approached by insulation companies who are talking about bypassing the builder market failure and going out and super insulating every new house in America to generate credits that they can then sell. So if you're putting aside credits for engines that drive emissions reductions, then that is the efficient way to cope with global warming, not giving them to people that are trying to keep from changing. So when we do this, you know, there has to be that incentive for the real engines of change out there. And we also have to have a system that doesn't excessively control the price. Because the more expensive those credits are, the more drivers of change you're going to have out there doing things that reduce emissions in a big hurry. You know, we need to focus on both the new building environment and the built environment. You know, retrofits are an incredibly important part of this. There are things like the Weatherization Assistance Program and things that are in place that need help, that need money. It's a tough fiscal climate on the Hill, but you know, there are more people paying attention than have been paying attention probably since 1979. So just in closing, you know, we have a moment of huge opportunity, and we need the help of everyone. And now somebody may ask me, so do you think global warming legislation will be passed this Congress? And it is energizing and exciting and motivating to see how much focus there is on it. I think between the industries arrayed against change, which have gone from opposing, you know, life was easy when it was like, we support controlling global warming and you don't. Now it's like everybody supports global warming, and the devil is in the details about how we do it. And they, you know, the folks that have gone from opposing and are now have theoretically had a conversion will very likely be trying to pass something that does nothing. And if, in fact, you know, the scientists are right, the worst thing that can happen to us right now is a placebo that puts us 15 years from here, and we haven't done anything and haven't made any progress. And, you know, we really need to make sure that that doesn't happen. So no economist has ever disagreed with me when I've said, do you agree that it's difficult to construct a cap-and-trade system that doesn't have loopholes in it? And nobody has said, oh, yeah, sure, we can do that. It's no sweat. So the whole the building of the policy process is going to take a long time. It'll be very difficult. There is a lot of momentum and excitement about doing something soon, but I wouldn't be very surprised if it took longer in this Congress. So that's what I got. Thanks for listening to me.
I'll start. There have been a lot of issues around the commercial side with Green Building Council, around the issue of not that their standards are pretty good, but the process, the bureaucratic process of actually complying with them and being certified is extremely expensive, and some critics have said redundant. We are involved with the residential side, their pilot, and I think that the challenge we have is how do you both establish standards and then establish a process to verify those standards. It's not cumbersome, and that the very certification process, to say that you did it, costs you more than doing it. And that's a challenge with the issues of additionality and leakage on cap and trade programs, and it's a challenge for all of us on building high performance buildings on both setting the standards and getting there and verifying it inexpensively. Got to go well beyond where they're at, and the operation and maintenance is absolutely critical.
One of the aspects of LEED that not many people are familiar with is that energy efficiency is only a small portion of the total LEED qualification package, and it's quite possible to get a LEED qualification, even a silver, without hitting the top level of energy efficiency. So one of the things that we're pushing as an organization is energy efficiency first, and trying to show LEED designers that energy efficiency projects can help pay for some of the other aspects of a green building.
I'm a LEED accredited professional, and your comments go very deep. Your points is that, and I just want to reiterate this, because I've actually taken like the Microsoft Pebble Beach campus to LEED existing buildings program for the pilot.
Wondering about reaching into the private sector and looking at new development, publicly subsidized development, and also residential retrofitting and construction. Is there a role for local government in, for example, aggregating the various, sometimes confusing, subsidy programs? Helping people figure out how to turn their home green. And then the last question is, a couple of people have made reference to, there's lots of money in the system, there's lots of money floating around. Is that money actually usable for training dollars, mm-hmm. like to actually get people into these jobs, or how much of that money is really just about bricks and mortar?
I'll start. You had a lot of unbelievably good questions. Where to start? But I would just add that one of the frustrations I've had, I sit on the board of a national nonprofit called the Building Performance Institute, and we're designing and promoting certification, training, and accreditation in the building renovation industry. And there's a similar organization for new construction called ResNet, and they're working and working together. The biggest failure that, or challenge that has not been achieved is how to link that with the building trades, the unionized building trades in this country, or even the non-unionized, the building trades, period. The building trades have been very much siloed by, in the guild, the craft methodology, and either we have to create a new set of building categories, building skill categories that can be unionized, or you have to create cross currents across. There's nothing worse than seeing an insulation job done really well and the plumber come and rip it to hell. And then the electrician comes and rips it to hell. And all when you're finished, none of it works right, right? Because the building industry has been siloed into pieces that don't respect each other's, not trade so much as end performance. So I haven't figured out where, I think there's some skill sets and some skill training issues that have to be addressed, but the organizational barriers on the construction, the private construction to the trade union, we have to work very hard to figure out how to do that.
I'd like to look at a slightly different piece of your terrific questions. When you look at green building laws that are New York City's law, Boston's law, there's one that's coming to San Francisco fairly soon, East Bay, I don't know, you would know better than I. They're all different. Some of them only capture public buildings, a number of them are. Washington's is much more, it has lower standards, but it says you build it, you've got to build it green. It phases in over a number of years, but it will, by the year 2012, if all goes well, it will capture everything. It's worth looking at these different laws. It's also, I think, very important to be meeting with people, the money people in the private sector, mortgage people, underwriters, the people who pay for, provide the debt for construction and the insurance that underwrites some of that, to educate them that green building is viable, is persuasive, will substantially cut down on operating costs. If you're thinking about affordable housing, it's worth investing building green because it will really help to ensure that the building will be affordable out over the long run for the tenants who live there. And that's just another piece of that puzzle.
I mean, I can answer more the questions offline and can get information to you as well. But I just wanted to say, I mean, this whole Apollo initiative, et cetera, I mean, this is really about political power, right? And so this is about what we need to be organizing our power to make this green economy what we want. And so it's not just now, oh, suddenly we're all looking at the data and it's all saying it's win, win, win. This is about the political power we've been able to build so far and where we're willing to take it. And so what we are about in Los Angeles is about expanding the public sector, not weakening it, but this is about expanding the public sector, expanding the private sector as well, but through unionization. So this is, we're clear about where we want to go, and it really is about, there are examples of doing workforce training, et cetera, but we really are at a point where if it's important to us, we need to create it ourselves. And we need to make those connections with the building trades. And I think the building trades in some of the building trades unions in Los Angeles realize that they have to be at they need to be at the forefront of making this happen. It's not about somebody else making those connections, but it's about training your own workforce and creating more jobs.
Right, and historically in the energy services industry over the last 10 or 15 years, every time there's a little jump in public consciousness which gives a little spur to the industry, the first thing we hit is a shortage of skilled workers. I mean, it's, you know, there's a the gap is even shorter. There's I can't think of a single company in our trade association who's not staff constrained at this point.
I just wanted to add one thing to your question, which is I didn't talk a lot about what the Sierra Club's actually doing, but I would like to just point up the mayor's climate protection agreement and the fact that there are now 360 some mayors who have pledged to make changes in their city buildings, in their city infrastructure that would reduce emissions to roughly Kyoto places. And the Sierra Club kind of jumped on and said, well, if I think there were 120 when we jumped on and said, you know, if 120 mayors have signed this, probably 111 don't know what it would actually take to do this. So we have been trying to work. We now have 170-some independent campaigns around the country, and our Cool Cities program is really about building local coalitions with labor, with faith groups, with public health and trades to kind of get this stuff off the ground with cities. So I urge you to kind of seek those out and you know, where available.
Yes, ma'am. I've just been given the signal that we're at time. I guess if people would like to stay and continue the conversation, some of the panelists will stay. But Dan, you would.
Yeah. No. I'm really very pleased at the enthusiasm, the number of questions here. But I also don't want folks to feel like they can't take their break and move toward lunch. We don't want to have the program sort of sliding back through the day. So. Well, thank our panelists and take a break.